then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of...
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 11th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
Okay, we have a few Edgar Steele updates for you. To begin with, after almost 15 months, I myself have finally gotten a letter from Ed, which reads as follows, and it's dated July the 29th, 2011. Dear Harold, finally they showed me some old account sheets. Thank you for the kind and generous contribution to my coffee and stamp fund. As an aside, this refers to $100 that I sent to Edgar Steele over 1 year ago. He has just now been informed about it. Anyway, back to his letter. He says, I've heard that you've written a couple of articles in my support. I appreciate that. Thanks. Would you please send me copies? I seem to be getting mail that is sent to me at this jail, which is quite a change, I'll tell you. Now, this is a real battle I'm in, but I am far from done. Now I've got them just where I want them. I intend to give no quarter as we get into the short strokes. I will be back. All the best, Ed. And by the way, for those of you who would like to write to Edgar Steele, the address is, I think, sufficiently simple so I can give it out on the air here. It's Edgar Steele, Latah County Jail. Or Latah, I'm not sure how you pronounce that. L-A-T-A-H, Latah County Jail. Post Office Box 8068, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Edgar Steele, Latah County Jail, Post Office Box 8068, Moscow or Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Ed's sentencing has now been postponed until the middle of November, which is almost exactly 6 months after he was convicted. Now, I know some guys who've had some contact with the system, and they tell me that something's definitely going on here. A six-month delay between conviction and sentencing is almost unheard of, even for these sons of bitches in our present so-called judicial system. And it most likely indicates some kind of problem or dispute within the power structure over the way the case was handled by the judge or the FBI. So they're holding off on sentencing just to make absolutely sure they've got all the loose ends tied up and they don't embarrass themselves after they send Steele to his death with any threads coming unraveled, so forth and so on. In fact, for some reason, they may actually be holding off on sentencing Ed Steele until Larry Fairfax, the FBI informer who actually committed all the criminal activity, gets out of jail on his own sweetheart sentence, which should be about that time. Now, back in June, Fairfax ended up getting a few token years, which, with time served and good behavior, we were told at the time, meant that he could be back on the street by Christmas. Now, Fairfax's exact whereabouts seemed to be something of a state secret, but the birdies tell me that he has stayed in county jail due to so-called overcrowding and the shortness of his sentence. And so apparently the man who actually wired the bomb to Cindy Steele's car and who quote-unquote forgot to tell the FBI about it will never do one single day in actual prison, unlike Edgar Steele, who's looking at 70 years for not one single overt act, only for words. Words which it looks more and more as if Steele never actually spoke. Now, I talked with someone who's close to the family, and the attitude seems to be that Ed's new lawyer, Wesley Hoyt, is putting up a real bear of a fight for a new trial based on the first trial judge's outrageous decision not to allow Ed to call his technical witnesses and not to allow the defense to present any forensic evidence to the first jury on the grounds that it would impugn the non-existent integrity of the FBI. Hoyt is also apparently demanding a new trial on grounds of ineffective counsel. Ed's first attorney, you will remember, was a man named Roger Peven, or Peven, who is the federal public defender for the Northwest and who's been in and out of expensive government rehab clinics for alcoholism, and who is now being sued by two members of his own staff, basically for being insane. Interestingly enough, Peven, or Peven, is still the official defense attorney for Kevin Harpham, the accused Spokane backpacker, which I'm sure fills Kevin with confidence. Edgar Steele's second attorney, Robert McAllister, was disbarred for corruption and embezzlement 2 weeks after his client was convicted. And so basically, Ed Steele has had two defense attorneys. One was a drunk and one was a thief. Really great country and a really great legal system we got here, huh? One final comment. I find it interesting that the Spokane County Jail has now dropped their unique correspondence policy put into place when Edgar was housed there of not allowing prisoners to receive letters, but only postcards. Now that Steele is no longer an inmate, for some reason the Spokane County Jail no longer has any objection to jail inmates receiving actual letters anymore. Okay, I have an emailed question, and I'm sorry to say that, as so often happens in all my shifting and forwarding and cutting and pasting of this email, I have lost the original tagline, and I have no idea who it's from. I think it's from a guy named Jesse, but I honestly can't recall if it's Jesse in Alaska or Jesse in Mississippi. Anyway, the email goes as follows. Dear HAC, I have a question about the party. In the Constitution, the party is mentioned many times. What exactly is the party? Is the party the people that fought in the liberation of the Northwest Republic? What privileges is the party to have and what role shall it play? And is the party hereditary? I sure hope not, because hereditary oligarchies last shorter than adoptive ones. The Catholic Church outlasted all the monarchies, but the handful that remain. In the Northwest Republic, how would one have membership in the party? Anyway, I think this would be a great topic for next week's Radio Free Northwest. Okay, Jesse, first question. Have you read the four Northwest novels? And by the way, that question is for everybody and not just on this topic. Now, the reason I ask is not because I'm some egotistical author who wants everybody to buy my books and bask in what a brilliant and witty SOB I am. The reason I ask is that so many of these questions that I get every week are, in fact, already answered, often in great detail, in the four Northwest novels. Now, that's why they were written, to answer these questions in a permanent and coherent form to which people can be referred over the years. It's really difficult and frustrating for me to try and talk to people who have not read at least one or two of these books, because pretty much everything you want to know is in them. In those books, in the format of fiction, I not only give you a lot better and more coherent and better organized and presented answer, but I can speak so much more freely in the novels than I can here. The novels are also more permanent and better accessible. Now, Jesse, I could spend the rest of this podcast talking about the role of the party in the Northwest Republic. Now, if memory serves, this, I believe, is going to be Radio Free Northwest number 81. In a couple of weeks, this podcast will be forgotten by those of you who listen to it basically for entertainment, which is most of you. And whatever I say here will be superseded by whatever other entertaining things I might say in the next podcast. Within a matter of a few months or so, no one will download this podcast and listen to it other than secret police and left-wing NGO spies. And my answer to Jesse's question, however extensive and comprehensive it might be, will be lost until a couple of months from now, when someone who has not heard this podcast asks it again, and then I have to go over the whole thing again. Now, this is why we need things like the Northwest novels, and why I have to keep and send out canned answers to FAQs. I do a lot of spaced repetition on these Radio Free Northwests. I understand that necessity. But the fact is that once I do it on a show, like I said, in a couple of weeks, everybody's going to forget it, which is one of the reasons I have to keep on doing it, blah, blah, blah. I repeat that the answers to almost all of your questions are in the four Northwest novels. You need to use that as your baseline. These questions are usually dealt with in the novels at some length and in great detail. Now, you really, really need to read those books. I didn't write the books to make money, which is probably one reason I have so little of it in my pocket. I wrote those books so that they could be read and their message understood. So if any of you are genuinely too poor to order the books themselves from Amazon.com, you can contact me at nwnet@earthlink.net, and I will send you one of several PDF format free download sites, and you can either read the book on your computer or you can print out a hard copy on your printer. Now, failing all else, I will actually send you a copy of one or more of the novels in PDF format by email attachment. Now, moving a little bit closer to Jesse's actual question, as some of you will be aware, I am presently working on the fifth Northwest novel, Freedom's Sons, a book which begins where the Brigade left off and which will follow three white families through the first 50 years of the Northwest American Republic's existence. The purpose of this novel, as was the purpose of the first four, is to answer all kinds of questions at length, in detail, and much more freely than I could answer them if I just sat here and babbled into a microphone for a podcast, which will be forgotten this time next week when RFN number 82 comes out. Right now, my plans call for Freedom's Sons to have five sections covering this 50-year period in the future. I've recently completed the first draft of Section 1 and Section 2 of this novel, and I've published a few of the draft chapters on the Thought Crime blog as previews of coming attractions. Unfortunately, once I get these first two sections completely ready for the public and published on the internet, which should be in a few weeks, I'm going to have to take a hiatus of indeterminate length while I deal with some stuff. I won't get into that, but when I do resume writing the fifth Northwest novel, beginning with Section 3, will be almost 30 years into the Republic's existence, and this very question of Jesse's, of how a unitary state works in an independent white republic, how it functions in practice, all of this will be dealt with at great length and in great detail, and in a format where it will eventually be published and become part of my canon, my body of work, and not just forgotten by next week when our usual 4,000 listeners log on to Radio Free Northwest number 82 for their week's entertainment. Now, Jesse, and all of you out there to whom this applies, what I want you to do now is, while we're waiting for me to finish Section 3 of Freedom's Sons, which will deal specifically, among other things, with your question, and which, with any luck, I may be able to do by the end of the year, what I want you to do between now and then is I want you to do your homework. The answers to virtually every question any of you could possibly have about the Northwest Migration or the Northwest Republic are already out there. You just have to find them. First, I would like for you to obtain, sit down, and read all four Northwest Independence novels. Then I would like for you to scour the northwestfront.org website. Finally, I would like for you to undertake what I understand is a pretty major internet project. I'd like for you to download and listen to all of the back episodes of Radio Free Northwest, going back to January of 2010. Not only will you hear a lot of groovy music, but the answer to every conceivable question that anybody could ever ask about us is on there, often more than once. Find those answers. I can guarantee you the experience will be well worth the time you invest in it.
Hi, guys. This is Axis Sally. And recently, a young man emailed me with a question about a situation he was having, something that's all too common in our movement. He and his girlfriend had just had a baby, and while he believed in the Northwest Migration and wanted to come home, she did not. And I was unclear if she was just not sold on our plan or if she was not racially aware at all. But either way, the couple was in disagreement, and with a new baby in the middle, there were not a lot of options. The partner who is not racially aware is, again, all too common. And from what I've seen, it's usually the man who is trying to convince the woman to come around to racial awakening. Although, of course, it does go both ways. And I'm sorry to tell you, I have no answers for you, at least not those you will want to hear. The reality is, people rarely change their personality or ideals during adulthood, and if they do, it needs to be something they do on their own, for themselves, and not due to outside influences. Anyone who has lived with an alcoholic or a video game playing TV watching loser knows this. You cannot force them to quit. You cannot reason or rationalize with them. They have to realize on their own that they are losers and decide to do something about it. And it's the same with the racially unaware partner. You can't turn them racist. Many women will try and go along with it for the sake of the relationship. They'll figure, well, I guess I don't really like niggers, and I don't see what's so bad about Jews, but I guess I can deal with this. But she's not truly racially aware. Being willing to deal with a partner's racism is nowhere near the same as knowing the truth about the Jewish problem, about the reasons for race-mixing propaganda being forced on us, or knowing that our race, the greatest creation ever to walk the earth, faces certain extinction in a very short time. And I know those of you who are lucky to be with one of the few surviving white females of childbearing age do not want to hear this. You don't want to hear that in a year or two, your little girlfriend will have renounced racism and renounced you, and if you're like most of us in the movement, she will have taken your children and placed serious restrictions on your access to them. The courts will never award custody to a racist unless the other parent is seriously unfit or abusive, and in that situation, they'll most likely seek a foster care placement. True, there are people in our movement who have managed to maintain custody of their children even after being dragged through the courts by their non-racist former partner, but those people have often done a lot of cooperating with the federals and continue to do so for years afterward with the constant threat of losing their children being held above them. No, listen to me, your girlfriend is not a racialist. It doesn't matter if she laughed at your racist joke. It doesn't matter if she came to your group's barbecue or bought the supporter t-shirt or came to one of your rallies. She's not one of us. Wait a year or two for the ultimatum and then make your decision. I can't tell you what to do. If the ultimatum is getting to raise your child versus getting to pass out flyers and look for recruits, no pro-family or pro-white group is going to tell you not to choose your child. The white race is going extinct and we must increase our numbers at any cost. I would rather see white children born outside the homeland or born to white couples who are not racially aware than not be born at all. The future of our race really is that bad. But Sally, people tell me all the time, you don't get it. I showed my girlfriend Mein Kampf and she said it was a good book. Of course she did. I seriously doubt she read it, but I definitely believe she told you it was a good book. Maybe next she'll say the N-word. White women of childbearing age make up 2% of the world's population. Of that small number, how many are still available? And of that even smaller number, how many of them are truly racially aware and not just going along with whatever their boyfriend does? I'm guessing that number is small enough to be statistically insignificant. If you have found one of these women, hang on to her and do whatever is necessary to produce more of our race.
Now, this is No Remorse.
Nothing's done. White man built the houses and
Okay, now this is normally where I would drop in a Dry Ice Washington clip, but folks, I have to admit that as the liberals would say, I've tried it a couple of times now, and I'm just not really comfortable with Dry Ice. Now, Dry Ice got his start back in the old days at Rockwell Hall on the old White Power hotlines, the recorded messages, and then on what we call the White Power Comedy Hour, which was a series of sketches that we did with the primitive audio gear of the time. And by the way, I was by no means the only Dry Ice Washington, and certainly not the best. Mike Whalen and Bob Pritchard were both infinitely better at that character than I ever was. But frankly, this is a much uglier and more serious age, so to speak, with way too much at stake, and so Dry Ice just doesn't translate all that well. Now, probably this is because I'm just becoming such a crotchety and irritable old coot in my old age, but he just doesn't strike me as funny or appropriate anymore. Now, this week we had an incident at the Wisconsin State Fair where hundreds of niggers from a flash mob they assembled off Facebook and Twitter went berserk, swarmed over the parking lot, and attacked white people at random, pulling them out of cars, beating them, stabbing them, not even robbing them in some cases. It was pure, racially motivated violence based on hatred for the color of our skins by animals. And needless to say, other than Matt Drudge, virtually no media outlet in this country covered these events, and they have now dropped out of sight. But when I was looking over the net trying to find something Dry Ice Washington might want to comment on, and something I could work up into a routine, I kept coming back to this thought of whether or not any of the victims of those racial attacks in Wisconsin were to listen to this podcast, and if so, would they see the humor in Dry Ice? And then I thought of Channon Christian and Chris Newsom, the young white couple from Knoxville, Tennessee, who were slaughtered by blacks in one of the worst racial assaults in this country's history, and which the law and the media still refuse to designate as a hate crime, and Dry Ice just kind of deflated in my mind. Now, the fact is that niggers just aren't funny to me anymore, and that means that even if I could work up a script, I doubt if I could pull it off. My heart wouldn't be in it. Now, okay, I know that people want some comic relief to vary my usual tirade of ranting and raving on here. I get that, and I'll do what I can to provide it, but at least it'll be white comedy. I'm reminded of that guy last week who objected to too much Southern hillbilly and rednecky stuff, and so I decided to see what I could come up with by way of Southern humor. Now, this first cut is from Justin Wilson, the Cajun chef. I don't know if any of you remember him or not. I'm playing it because it occurs to me that most of you have probably never even heard the Louisiana Cajun dialect before. Matter of fact, some of you probably don't even know what a Cajun is. They are the French-speaking poor whites of Louisiana, as opposed to the Creoles, who are the rich plantation owner types. Now, here's some real minority community representation. I'm going to follow up with a clip from the late Louis Grizzard, who is from Georgia. Now, not all Southern dialects are alike, and you can tell if you listen close enough. Far from it. Now, see if you can tell the difference between Louisiana and Georgia here.
Hi, y'all. I'm glad for you to see me guarantee. Don't just sit there, laugh. That's more better. I'm going to tell you some stories to make you laugh, I think. So I'll start right now. You know, this story would remind me about something I got to tell you about. And it just tickled me to death because it's supposed to be true. Down in Crowley, Louisiana, I got a friend that's got a big rice farm. And he raised cattle, too, down there. And one day he was in his house watching television for the midday news. And flap, 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 somebody done knock on his door, you know. And he goes to the door and there's one of them bureaucrats. And he don't even introduce himself. He pulled a laminated card out of his pocket and he chunk it right in that Cajun face. He say, you see them cards? My friend say, I got to. It's in my heart. He said, well, that card give me the authority and the right and the privilege to look at anything I want to on your place. That card say, you can't stop me. I look all I want. There ain't a thing you can do about that. I'm going to look. My friend say, go ahead and look till your eyeballs fall on the ground. That's all right with me. So he laughed. And my friend went back in to see the rest of the news. And after a while, he hear out there, help, help, won't you help me? Please help, help. Well, he run outside and he go back up his barn where he got a big corral back there and he got his prize Santa Gertrudis bull back there. He go back there And there that bureaucrat running round and round in them prize bull, three step behind him trying to make it three all the time, trying to make it just two. He get there real close and he run by, help, help, please help me. Help, help, please help me. You watch him come by there a third time and he say, help. He say, show him your card, show him that card you got.
General Sherman was leaving Atlanta, 1865. After he burned it down, he was going out I-20. He gets on the Stone Mountain Freeway. He gets just outside of Stone Mountain, got 125,000 Yankee soldiers behind him. They're going by Stone Mountain, suddenly they hear a voice. And they look up on top of Stone Mountain. There's one lone Confederate soldier standing on top of Stone Mountain, got his saber drawn. And he's talking real nasty to him, saying ugly things to the Yankees. And General Sherman calls a halt to his crowd, and he said, listen, we got to get this guy off here. It's bad public relations for us. Hell, we got CBS News with us, USA Today. Said, who's the toughest man in the outfit? He said, a fellow named Swartz from Minnesota's the toughest man we got. He said, send Swartz up there, get that Confederate off of there. Swartz goes to the top of Stone Mountain. He ain't there 5 minutes, he comes flying off the mountain. Hits and splats right in front of General Sherman. General Sherman said, send 10 men up there. And they send 10 Union soldiers to the top of Stone Mountain. Not a one lives to tell the story. General Sherman said, this is terrible. So we got to do something about this. He said, find the 150 finest men we got in this company and send them up there to get that rebel off the top of that mountain. 150 Union soldiers go to the top of Stone Mountain. Only one lives to tell the story. And he comes back off Stone Mountain, and he's bleeding from every pore of his body. Don't look good at all. And he walks up to General Sherman. General Sherman said, son, what's the story up there? And the soldier said, it's a trick, General Sherman. There's two of them.
I will say this, if any of you out there by any chance do have copies of any of the old White Power Comedy Hour cassette tapes that we made back in the 70s and 80s in Chicago, please send them to me, or if you can find some way to do so, transfer them to CD, and I can convert them to MP3 on my machine here. Now, those I will play, and if that ever becomes possible, then you'll be able to hear Dry Ice as he should be heard, a voice from an older and more innocent age. Back when we used to laugh a lot in the movement.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally, and I'm going to lay a few words on you on the subject of this week's Black Rioting Worldwide. It looks like niggers have finally learned to use the internet. Their latest trick is to assemble what they call flash mobs using Twitter, Facebook, and other social networking sites in order to attack whites or sometimes to rob specific stores. For some reason, in Chicago, they're really going after Walgreens. The dark-skinned inhabitants of the Third World City of London have gone one better. They are looting and burning whole neighborhoods and using their cell phones and Blackberries to keep each other informed of where the police are and what stores and shopping areas are unguarded. In Britain, the rioters are both black and Asian Muslim, along with a bunch of left-wing Uyghur anarchists, I'm sorry to say. As of today, the authorities in the UK are threatening to use water cannons on them, but I doubt that will work, although it will have the good effect of making some of those stinky Jamaicans finally take a bath. During the last really bad outbreak of rioting in Great Britain, the Broadwater Farm riots in 1985, a white police officer named Keith Blakelock was decapitated and his head was paraded around the estate on a stick, a little detail which somehow never seems to make it into all this recent news coverage. I guess the Brits have short memories. This doesn't bode well for London's few remaining white residents. In one of the most disgraceful aspects of the last 70 years of uncontrolled third world immigration into Europe, Britain's capital city, once the capital of the greatest white empire the world has ever known, has been allowed to fill up with huge numbers of blacks, Muslims, and other third world elements who should not be there at all. The riots are still going on as I speak, and now they have spread to the also majority non-white city of Birmingham. Here in this country, we had a flash mob of several hundred coons attacking whites in the parking lot of the Wisconsin State Fair in Milwaukee, pulling white people out of their cars and beating them, slashing them with box cutters, and clubbing them with sticks and rocks in the best Stone Age tradition. The reaction of the media and police in Milwaukee was to scream at the top of their lungs that it wasn't racially motivated, and the fact that all of the attackers were black and all of the victims were white is just a really bizarre coincidence. Yeah, right. There have also been riots in Philadelphia where there's a nigger mayor named Michael Nutter. Mayor Nutter imposed a curfew in most of the city's black neighborhoods and announced that anyone under 18 in those areas must now be off the streets by 9 p.m. And when parents come to pick up curfew violators, the mayor said, they'll be told to keep track of the child. Oh, yeah, that'll work. That will do an immense amount of good. For one thing, most slum Negroes don't have parents. They generally live with grandmothers or aunts or someone who collects their welfare allowance. The nigger mayor threatened his homies, if you don't even bother to pick up your child, we are immediately calling the Department of Human Services and you can then be taken to court for other violations, including neglect of your child. Again, that is hardly going to be a deterrent. Has it occurred to anyone that if these creatures were afraid of the law or the police, they wouldn't be rioting? In addition, Nutter said 20 city recreation centers will be open later until 10 p.m. on Friday and Saturday nights. Hey, I haven't heard that one in a long time. Liberals believe the old idea that young black males can't resist a basketball, and if you can just keep them shooting hoops all night, they won't rob and burn and rape and kill. Okay, so now we've got another long, hot summer in every sense of the term. We seem to go through this every 20 years or so, and yet we never seem to learn, and we always act like we're so surprised when it happens. What? Blacks rioting? Why, that's never happened before. I'm shocked. Shocked, I tell you. One of the more interesting aspects of all of this is that in both the British media and the American press, race is almost never mentioned at all anywhere in any of the articles or in any of the other coverage of the flash mobs that have been operating all summer. In some cases, such as the recent attacks on white people at the Wisconsin State Fair, the news got out anyway, thanks to Matt Drudge. Drudge seems to be the only mainstream news source who will report racial attacks on whites anymore. Do I really need to state the obvious? In Britain, the issue is even more clear-cut than it is here in this country. We have huge numbers of black savages rioting and burning and looting in a country where they do not belong, and from which they should, by rights, be removed using such force as is necessary to return the island of Britain to its original inhabitants. In this country, we should be used to it by now. Every summer, niggers stage small riots all over the USA, and every 20 years or so, we have major outbreaks that actually get a little media attention, and we simply come to accept that we have a segment of our population that routinely uses violence to get what they want, or else just because they're bored. We see what is in front of us, and we all know what we should be doing about it, but we are afraid to do it because the big bad policeman might hurt us. And so it goes on and on and on while we wring our hands and weep to one another on the internet over how terrible and bad it all is. Until one day we will all be very old, and they will come for us, and there will be no one left to protect us from the big black and brown boogeymen, and we will die in agony and terror. I'm sorry, I know the truth is terribly unpalatable and no one wants to hear it, but somebody has to say these things. America is not going to get better unless white people step up and take control again, and how likely is it that that will happen? We have tried integration and diversity and equality and all that BS. It's been 57 years now, over half a century, and clearly it isn't working. These black-skinned things are not equal. They will never become responsible and functioning citizens, and we need to stop pretending otherwise and do something about it. Like forming our own country for whites only here in the Pacific Northwest.
Second music break. This is an old Kingston Trio song. Yes, I know, that dates me like hell, but I actually think the Kingston Trio were pretty good folk singers and musicians.
He was born and raised around Jacksonville. A nice young man, not the kind to kill, but a jealous fight and a flashing blade sent him on the run through the Everglades, running like a dog through the Everglades. A man can live in the Everglades, where a man can hide and never be found, and have no fear of the baying hound. But he better keep him moving and don't stand still. If the skeeters don't get him, then the gators will. Now the years went by
guy and his girl was wed. His family gave him up for dead. But now and then the native would say they seen him running through the Everglades,
running like a dog through the Everglades.
Now he never heard the news on the radio. He was deep in the glades, so he'll never know. His running and hiding didn't make much sense, for the jury had ruled it was self-defense.
Running like a dog through the Everglades, where a man can hide and never be found, and have no fear of the baying hound. But he better keep moving and don't stand still. If the skeeters don't get him, then the gators will. Running like a dog through the Everglades, skipping like a frog through the slimy bog, running through the trees from the Everglades.
Email from a very old comrade indeed, Kathy in Boca Raton, Florida. Dear Harold, you speak a lot about white people's character flaws and the issues that we have with character. And I, of all people, know that's true. Yeah, you do. But I think you need to get a lot more specific and make sure everybody understands exactly what it is that we do wrong all the time. The devil is in the details. Oh boy, Kath, you've really opened a can of worms there. Okay, after some reflection, I think you're right. I complain a lot about our weak and unfit character, and it could be that a lot of people out there who have no personal experience with the movement are unsure exactly what I'm talking about. Although let me hasten to say that I'm not just talking about movement people here, and don't worry, I'm not going to violate the last taboo and name the precious names. Because, like I said, I'm not just talking about the movement. As I learned at Decision 1 all those years ago, these things aren't just movement problems anymore. They're white racial problems that have contaminated virtually all of us to one degree or another. Movement people simply seem to display them a lot more prominently, but this is damage that the Jews have inflicted on all our people. Okay, first off, if I had to pick what is probably our absolute worst moral character flaw, I would need to find a word which expresses the concept of a half and half combination of both cowardice and laziness. I could say that we are pusillanimous, and that would do it, that we display pusillanimity. But these are unusual words, they have too many syllables, they're hard to pronounce, and so white people under 40 won't get it. I need something that Beavis and Butthead and Clueless will understand, and so let's just say that our main character flaw is that white people as a whole are chicken shit. Now, that pretty much says it, I think. Now, let me make something clear. I'm not calling us cowards just because all you guys refuse to act out my novels and rise up and get guns and form the NVA and run the United States out of the Northwest. Two things about that. First off, yes, for the record, we could do that if we had the balls and the brains. And I hope that one day we as a people will make that choice. But the second point is that that is not, in fact, what I'm asking of you right now, and I have never asked that of you. My problem with your cowardice and laziness involves your refusal to commit a perfectly legal act, which is, in fact, to your personal benefit and the benefit of your family in the long run, and which most of you would commit without a second's hesitation if you were offered money to do so. My primary bitch is that I can't get you guys to do something because it is right. The very same thing that you would do tomorrow morning if you were paid. There are more kinds of cowardice than a simple fear that if you step out of line, the big bad policeman will come with his flashing blue lights and hurt you. Although that is, of course, a very common type. We're both physical cowards who are terrified of real threats that do exist, and mental cowards who are terrified of a lot of threats that exist only in our minds. We're not only cowards, we're aces at finding things to be cowardly about. One thing that distinguishes white people in the 21st century is that we live in a constant state of fear, apprehension, and worry about everything. We are paranoid to the point of being dysfunctional. and it's due mostly to the behavior of other people whom we are forced to live with or around and whom we cannot escape. Now, most of us have simply forgotten what it is to be happy, if we ever knew. We've forgotten what it is to be calm and easy about life, because there are so many other people out there whose behavior is causing us terrible harm and creating insurmountable problems. We are surrounded by bad people over whom we have no control, and we have no way to make these other people stop doing what they're doing. We do have a way, but we won't use it. The big bad policeman might hurt us. Now, the fact is that almost all of everyone's problems in life are caused in one way or another by people. People who can often be identified by name and location. But we're afraid to deal with these people as we should because we're scared shitless that the big bad policeman might hurt us. This sense of powerlessness drives us cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Most white people go through their daily lives in a constant state of stress based on fear of what is going to happen to them and their families. Sometimes fear of magical, mystical boogeymen like global warming and alien abductions, but more often fear of what other people who have some kind of power over us are going to do to us and our families. Usually it's petty economic power, like our imbecile supervisor at whatever crappy job we've ended up stuck in. But sometimes, as with niggers and Mexican gangbangers, it's the power to assault, rob, and harm us without punishment that these creatures have been given by Jewish society. We fear our sick and twisted boss at work, who might decide to lay off all the middle-aged white guys. We fear niggers at the Wisconsin State Fair, who might drag us out of our cars and kill us. We fear the regime. We fear the criminal mulatto Barack Hussein Obama himself. Some of us are afraid of abstract things, like growing old, of course, but the things that make growing old or getting sick in this society so terrible are caused by specific and identifiable people. The people who exercise power in this society. And that includes the privileged black and brown-skinned minority who have the right to inflict criminal violence on people with white skins with legal impunity. We are afraid that today is the day that we will draw the short straw. Today is the day it will be our turn. The day that one of these many ugly and dangerous people will choose on some whim to exercise their power on us or our families like a little boy pulling wings off flies. White Americans are always afraid, with reason, that today might be the day someone decides we have too much and decide to shear or harvest us like livestock, possibly even slaughter us if we don't cough up the golden eggs. The result of all this is a terrible level of stress and constant inner turmoil in white people that produces everything from high blood pressure and heart problems to substance abuse to mental illness. Every day, thousands of white men and women simply crack under the strain of living in Obama's America. Well, they do it in 100 different ways, everything from alcoholism to losing themselves in some online video game to fighting with one's spouse and yelling at the kids, all the way up to flipping out and going down to the local shopping mall with a gun. White people are afraid of everything. We're not just afraid of genuine threats like violent nigger attack. We're afraid of Muslim terror attacks because the government tells us to be, even though there have only been about 3 or 4 genuine such attacks in the past 10 years. All of them except 9/11 were carried off by pissed off individual Muslims and not Al-Qaeda, which in my opinion may not even exist. But we're like that. We allow our politicians in Hollywood to program our minds to the point where half of the things that we believe in aren't true. Al-Qaeda, global warming, debt default if Obama doesn't get his way. Now, half of the things we're afraid of are simply hoaxes or internet issues with nothing to do with the real world. In addition to being yellow, white people are bone-idle lazy, not just physically but mentally. I'm convinced that a lot of the reason that most of you won't come home to the Northwest, where you know you're supposed to be, is because you don't want to have to go through all the physical effort of moving. I've noticed that our resolve to come home usually takes a nosedive when these guys actually go in and start cleaning out their garage for the first time. Usually after a few hours of shuffling the boxes around, they end up back on the sofa with the TV remote in their hand and a cold beer on the coffee table. White people will do anything to avoid physical effort and avoid being compelled to think rather than to feel. It's so much easier to use our emotions rather than our brains, and the overall feminizing of white society and culture has encouraged and indeed substituted the use of emotions over thought and analysis. The result is that white males do whatever they can to get out of having to do any heavy lifting in any sense of the term, physical or moral. When there's any heavy lifting to be done, we either hire Mexicans or we hire politicians to do it, depending on what kind of heavy lifting it is. White people, especially white males, refuse to grow up. We abdicate responsibility, and most of us never take any to begin with, because we've been taught by Hollywood and by television that our lives are supposed to be one long spring break full of beer and jackass-like stunts and beautiful babes with bouncing boobies. And if our lives aren't like that, then it's our fault because something's wrong with us and we are quote-unquote losers. And nobody in America wants to be a loser, now do we? Our world is full of white boys who are 30 and 35 years old, who bring their Transformers and childhood toys to work in their cubicles, and who are still living in their parents' basement. Our world is full of white girls who turn around and find themselves divorced in their mid-30s or early 40s, who wanted a career but who just ended up with a job, and there's a difference, and now they're old, their biological clocks are almost up, and even if they get knocked up right now, they will only ever produce one child, a child that they will probably have to raise without a male partner, because they themselves have been raised to be such bitches and they've driven their men away with their abuse and their demand for dominance. Okay, yeah, some white boys have been successfully conditioned to be subservient to women, but that's counter to basic biological instinct, and that's very hard even for 70 years of social engineering to eradicate. And the Jews haven't been completely successful yet in neutering the last of the white boys' Y chromosomes. But these middle-aged white women today are finding themselves alone, not just because of the poor general quality of white males, although I grant you that's not very good, but because they have bought into the incredibly unrealistic expectations that white women have been given about life from Hollywood and Oprah. White women today have been taught from birth by television and Hollywood and Oprah to believe that they have some God-given right to have it all. And by the time they realize that they've been gulled and that nobody, male or female, ever gets to have it all except Jews, then they're 38 or 40 or 42 and it's pretty much all over. In the battle of the sexes, the blame is about 50-50. But whoever's been to blame, the results have been disastrous. We have white people of both sexes entering their 40s now with no partner, either no children or else with one child who is most likely fucked up in a dozen ways, or else they're stuck in one of these bizarre American divorce scenarios, juggling parents and weekends and visitation rights over one or two children, yada, yada, yada. The Brady Bunch really is dead and gone. White people are fighting various alcohol and drug addictions. They're risking layoff from their jobs due to race and age. And they're living in a kind of daily horror and despair, which I sometimes find it hard to wrap my mind around. I mean, as horrible as my own life has been, at least I've always understood why it was happening. I had my National Socialist worldview to sustain me. And I always understood that when it got unbearable, escape was always as close as the nearest public library. I can't imagine what it must be like to be a white man or woman in their 40s or 50s, trapped in Obama's America, with nothing really but the computer and the television set, and not understanding why it's happening. Not having any clue as to what the hell's going on. Just knowing that there are people out there with power and privilege who can and will hurt you and your family anytime the mood takes them, and that there's nothing that can be done about it. It must kind of seem like being in hell when you're being tortured all the time by the little imps with the pitchforks and the torches. Now, time and again, I know we all ask ourselves, why? Why don't white men fight back? What the hell is wrong with us? Well, what's wrong with us is what I said earlier. We're chicken shit. It's that simple. Cowardice and laziness. Cowardice because we are afraid that if we fight back, the big bad policeman might hurt us. And yes, he'll try. laziness because we can't be bothered to go to the physical effort of coming to some place where there are others like us. We'd rather sit on the sofa all alone, crying in our beer, feeling sorry for ourselves because moving is too hard. Nothing in this world is so safe as hurting and oppressing American white people. Those niggers who attacked our people in the parking lot of the Wisconsin State Fair knew perfectly well that not one white man would raise so much as a fist in his defense, never mind a weapon. The political and ruling class that has inflicted everything from Obamacare to the IRS to John Stewart on us know that they are perfectly safe, that the one thing that will never happen in this country is that white people will ever rebel and forcibly remove them from power. The people who rule us know perfectly well that they can do anything they want to white people. And all we're going to do is call Rush Limbaugh and whine like the craven cowards we are. But of course, white people have other character problems as the result of growing up in a society completely contaminated with Jews and Jewish ideas. One of these is what I might refer to as the Casey Anthony syndrome. Total narcissism. Complete self-absorption to the point where even something like the psychological and emotional bond between mother and child, which used to be the strongest of all personal bonds, has been severed. Casey Anthony literally threw her little daughter away when she became a drag on her social life, and Casey wanted to go out partying. She got caught, and so now she's a tabloid monster. But Casey Anthony is actually a very typical white woman of her generation. A true psychopath, totally cut off from other members of her race. Totally self-absorbed, incapable of any kind of empathy with others, and of course, everything is always about her. Now, in a weird kind of way, Casey Anthony's recent trial and all of the media hoopla confirmed her own estimation of herself. Every young white girl and most young white boys these days think that they have a right to be celebrities. And if they can't get on Jersey Shore with Snooki and the Guidos, then they'll take Nancy Grace and TMZ.com and Court TV. Okay, I've been raving for a while, and so it's time for our third music break. I'm going to play a pavane for you, which is a medieval and early Renaissance dance tune. There's nothing like some 500-year-old disco music to get your mind off Snooki and the Guidos. This is the John Renburn Group.
Love.
Okay, I could go on and on and on and on about white character defects, and in future episodes I'm sure I will, but I know that what you want to hear is what you can do about it. Do I have some kind of magic beans that'll fix our broken racial character before it's too late? No, but you do. I can tell you what we need to do about this in a few sentences, or at least I can get you started. Hell, I can tell you what to do about it in just a few words. But the problem is, you're not going to do what I tell you because it's hard. Okay, I get it. And no one would be more astounded than me if all of you did listen to me and all of a sudden I get up one morning and I see 50 cars and moving vans without a state license plate sitting in my parking lot here. But I'll go ahead and tell you anyway. Now, the key to changing our character as individuals and as a race was given to us 2,000 years ago by the famous Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius in a book called Meditations. He laid it all out in two short, simple sentences. If it is not right, do not do it. If it is not true, do not say it. There it is, guys. That's all the moral instruction that any white man, woman, or child really needs in order to become a functioning human being. It is no coincidence that virtually every religion in the world has commandments that consist mostly of a whole string of thou shalt nots, because the whole experience of being human lies in an effort to rise above the level of an animal who lives for nothing but instincts and base appetites. Being a human being, as opposed to being a nigger, means the ability for the conscious mind to restrain instinct and impulse in the service of a higher purpose. This is the key to becoming new men and women, and the secret to becoming functioning revolutionaries and political soldiers of the Northwest Republic. It's not so much what you do, it's what you don't do. I have said before that our little movement is top-notch in providing example after example of how not to do it, of how to make people stay away from us in droves. Now, there's an old saying that when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you have to do is stop digging. We need to figure out what we're doing wrong, and here's the tricky part, we need to stop doing it. No, I mean really stop. Just say no to bad character. Just say no to weakness. Just say no to cowardice. Just say no to dishonesty. Just say no to laziness. Just say no to general bad craziness and comporting yourself in the manner of a horse's ass. It's like the secret to beating alcoholism, which is don't drink. Don't put alcohol into your mouth. Just don't do it. Yes, it really is that simple. Not just put post after post on the internet talking about it. I mean, we have to really stop what we've been doing and do things that have been historically proven to work. Starting with a viciously persecuted minority actually coming together physically for mutual protection and benefit and not running away and hiding from each other. Okay, now here's where it gets a bit tricky for me to be specific without breaking the last taboo and actually naming certain emperors who have no clothes and some of their equally naked acolytes, but I'll try. Now let's start with the subject of ESA, electronic screen addiction. We need to get ourselves off the drug of the electronic screen, both the television screen and the computer monitor. And yes, I understand the irony and hypocrisy of me giving anybody that kind of advice because I spend about 10 hours a day sitting in front of this screen. But I've got an excuse. I have to. It's my job, and this is our only available medium of mass communication. So until we do lose the internet, and we really do have to go back to those mimeograph machines in the garage, I'm going to have to be spending a lot of time on the computer. I should also point out, in my own defense, that I do not have access to cable TV, just a small set I used to play movie DVDs on if there's anything good at Blockbuster, and I don't watch television on my computer like so many people do now. Okay, I watch The Simpsons when they're on, but that's it. But really, guys, we need to understand that an addiction does not have to be a chemical substance like booze or drugs. It's possible to become addicted to electronic waves beaming at one's brain and causing altered consciousness, which basically is all a chemical does. What do you think white males are doing as they sit on the sofa and click the remote again and again and again, spinning through the channels like one endless sort of kaleidoscope? Some people liken this to turning themselves into a zombie, and that's not far from the truth, guys. People like that are anesthetizing their brains. They're inducing, or self-inducing, I should say, a hypnotic and euphoric state, just like they were knocking back a bottle of Jack Daniels. Then there's the form of electronic screen addiction that comes from online gaming like Ebony and World of Warcraft. I don't game. I even quit playing the standard solitaire game on the computer long ago because it was getting addictive. I recommend that if you must use a computer, use it for email and communication only, and for listening to Radio Free Northwest, of course, and keep all unnecessary surfing and general playing to a minimum. If you want recreation, find it someplace other than a computer. Now, you know all these stupid things we do on the internet? Let's just make a kind of an agreement between ourselves and ourselves. We're not going to do those things anymore. Let's see if we can at least cut down on the sheer volume of nonsense and nutty and silly stuff on the net that passes for white nationalism. Stay away from places like Stormfront and VNN. They don't produce anything, and they are a colossal waste of time. When you get the urge to tap out some stupid bullshit on the internet just to show how clever you are, just keep your damn finger off that mouse and don't do it. If you have to prove to yourself or others how clever you are, then you're not really very clever at all. Now, whenever you're on the internet and you get the urge to play, just don't do it. I know that's hard. Every now and then the temptation to use these machines just to play almost overwhelms me too, although I'm getting a lot better at fighting off that temptation. Now, you need to find something to do that is out of doors, out of your house or apartment, so that you have an actual sky above you and trees and plant life around you. I know this sounds petty and silly, but no joke, guys. You will be amazed how much spending as much of your time as possible outside in all weathers will do for your whole perspective and outlook, as opposed to living inside a flat screen. If at all possible, get yourself some kind of job that requires for you to be outside. Now, those electronic screens mess up our minds bad, and we need to kick the habit. Now, a major recommendation to change your character. You need to start reading books again. Learn to sit in a quiet space with no electronic images or moving pictures or sound in your ear. Nothing electronic coming into your brain at all. And read blocks of type for content, meaning that you read a block of text and you think about what it means. You look at moving pictures on a screen, you're going to tend to feel things. You're going to laugh, or you're going to cry, you're going to say, hey man, that's weird. You're going to respond emotionally. You need to start learning to read blocks of words and think about what they mean. Exercise your brain. Don't just let it be a kind of sponge soaking up electronic images and sound waves. Your brain is like any other muscle in your body. If you don't exercise it, it withers away and becomes useless, and all of a sudden you turn around and you become an American. There's going to be a lot more of this spiritual stuff in these podcasts from now on, since it seems to be what we need to hear. But I'll wind this up now. So that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.
Follow in their footsteps of the rising north.